history, friends, patrons, all, to Poland is not yet lost. Before we begin, it's very important I make you aware of something. If you haven't listened to the recent news episodes, then make sure you do that. Basically, the long and short of it is, we're releasing a historical fiction series and it's really exciting, but more importantly for you guys right now listening in, this is the last episode of Poland is not yet lost for, I'd say, about 2 years, and there's going to be other stuff that'll keep you tithed over in the meantime. But yeah, for all intents and purposes, Poland is not yet lost ends after episode 40, and then season 2, if you like, will be released sometime later. The main reason for this is because of the PhD and because I massively miscalculated my research and writing plans. But if you want to know more about that, listen to the Patreon update episode because I go into more detail there. Otherwise, I hope you enjoy this last episode of Poland for a while, and thanks so much for getting involved and for being enthusiastic about this series, because I've really enjoyed doing it. And when the circumstances are better, I can't wait to get back into it and research the second half of Poland is not yet lost. So last time, we looked in more detail at Augustus III and his tireless minister, Count Brühl, who attempted to get the best deal possible from the old allies in Austria and Russia, and the new paymaster in the French. Balancing these two power sources was a difficult act, and Count Brühl remained intensely wary of any notions of Brandenburg-Prussia somehow finding out about the whole thing and launching an attack in retaliation for Saxony's duplicitous deeds. In this episode, we spread our net out a bit wider to effectively bring the narrative up to the middle of the 18th century in 1750. Without any further ado, let's get into it, as I take you to 1748. Europe had just seen the Third Succession War in 50 years, a fact which pointed to the possibility that Europe's dynasties may not have been as stable as we often think. Affairs were far from set in stone in the eventful 18th century. One only had to look at what Brandenburg had just done to see that. Yet, as the historian Robert A. Kahn reminds us, it would be wise to remember that even while Vienna had been shaken, she was down but absolutely not out. Furthermore, of the three succession wars, it was Austria's which proved the least damaging to the prestige of the Habsburgs, certainly in comparison to those of Spain and Poland, which saw both of those powers rocked by invasion and destruction. Kahn wrote, "The loss of the fertile Silesian principalities, endowed with rich mineral resources and advanced industrial establishments, undoubtedly weakened the Habsburg Empire, apart from the serious decline in political prestige. Yet the loss of Silesia by itself did not represent a major shift in the national composition of the Habsburg power, which comprised, at the beginning of the Seven Years' War, excluding Belgium and Milan, 15 million people. Fewer than 1.5 million of them were inhabitants of Silesia, and a sizable proportion of them was of Polish nationality. The acquisition of Galicia in the first partition of Poland in 1772 changed the ethnic composition of the Habsburg monarchy, but it would be oversimplification to assume that Austria's participation in that partition was primarily dependent on the outcome of the Silesian Wars." The question remained then, how was Austria to guard itself against further attack from Brandenburg-Prussia, and what could Maria Theresa expect from Frederick the Great in the future? In last episode, we saw that the Austrians had come to an agreement with a Russian treaty in 1746, which they repeatedly invited both Saxony and Hanover to join in. The acquisition of either of these powers would not have been unusual. Poland-Lithuania was determinedly the Russian sphere of influence by this point, and while Empress Elizabeth maintained a semblance of Polish constitutional and political independence, there could be no question of the Commonwealth returning to a completely sovereign course. This, in at least some way, had been Augustus III's aim when he allowed for Count Brühl to go and negotiate with the French. Through agreements made with the French, Saxony could be ensured in the west with a French alliance and ensured in the east with its Polish domains thanks to a Prusso-Saxon alliance. All of these agreements would be sponsored and maintained by French money and pressures, with the aim of combating the alternative Austro-Russian coalition that was surely destined to welcome Britain-Hanover to its side in the near future. With the pro-Austrian sentiments not just of British political history, but also of the current political tandem in London of the two Pelham brothers, it seemed a sure thing that Britain would continue this trend and align itself with the Austro-Russian alliance, use diplomatic means to offset the impact presented by Brandenburg-Prussia, and achieve a kind of balancing game of its own in Scandinavia. This uniquely British solution to the problem didn't tend to factor in the freedom of action of the other powers, and so Count Brühl's Saxon adventures were treated with much hostility when it was learned that he had come to a French agreement. The British were allowed to be diplomatically fluid and hover in between coalitions, but nobody else could be permitted to do so. Where Poland factored into the equation boiled down to where it affected the Saxon angle. It was difficult to think of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth as a state in charge of its affairs. If it was not thought of as a Saxon appendage, it was imagined as a Russian satellite. It added extra weight to the Saxon punch, but that punch was fairly unimpressive to begin with, as we saw in the last episode. For these reasons, it's difficult to provide the kind of commentary on the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth in the 1740s and 50s that we'll be able to present in the decades afterwards. It was almost as though, once the Seven-Year War ended and Catherine the Great ascended to the throne of Russia, that Poland suddenly reminded everyone present that she was in fact an independent nation. It probably helped that 1763 was also the year in which Augustus III, and Count Brühl for that matter, both died, and this threw up a new succession question and a new struggle for political power in Saxony, which made the question of Poland no longer relevant. 1763 would see Saxony severed from its long-standing Polish connection, and from that moment, Europe regarded Poland less as a Saxon appendage and more as an element of Russian policy, which could add extra weight to the Russian punch. The problem for Europe was that the Russian punch was already impressive to begin with, unlike that of Saxony, and further contradicting the Saxon situation, Poland under Russia was far less quiet and far less agreeable. After its Saxon slumber, it seemed as though the Commonwealth was now ready to reassert itself again. In a sense, then, our story will be holding out for the early 1760s somewhat, because it is from that point that our narrative really begins to heat up, and more importantly, it becomes all about Poland. I'm aware that during the 1740s our story has seemed more like Europe featuring Poland than a history of that state, but this is my solemn vow that as soon as the sources align for us in a decade's time, we'll be returning to a deeper analysis of Polish affairs. For now though, even while the story won't be as in-depth as I'd like, you should still notice an upturn in analysis on Poland once we start the second season of Poland Is Not Yet Lost, of course, largely because the sources talk more about Poland in the 1750s and 60s than they did in the 40s. A key reason for this is seen in the activity of Saxon foreign policy under Count Brühl to make something out of the Saxon link to Poland, either through subsidies from France or through a better deal with the Austro-Russians. Throughout the negotiations, neither Brühl nor Augustus III were especially interested in Polish matters. Instead, it would be more accurate to note that both figures were interested in how they could use Poland to leverage their beleaguered electorate's position. The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was not a realm of Augustus III. Instead, it was a jetpack which would empower Saxony to rise above its neighbours. Seen in this light, what ended up happening upon the outbreak of the Seven Years' War makes all the more sense. 1756 was the year of the diplomatic revolution, so called because it saw the incredible turnaround in European relations, whereby the eternal enemies of Austria and France joined forces, and Britain joined itself to the previously ostracized Prussia. As we'll see in episodes to come, the diplomatic revolution was by no means a clear-cut transition from one diplomatic system to another, not least because the years before had been anything but clear-cut. The 18th century expert Jeremy Black has written extensively on the relations of the powers in this era, and he commented on the diplomatic revolution from a revisionist perspective when he noted that British policy towards Austria in the decades before the diplomatic revolution can be seen not as the product of a generally accepted desire for an alliance believed to be the natural and inevitable consequence of an international system revolving around the threat of France, but rather as a sequence of fragile alignments whose short-term nature was disguised by talk of a natural alliance. Yet, although the diplomatic revolution may not have been all that significant, if measured purely in terms of the new alliances which were pursued, one interesting way in which it did resemble a shift of some significance was in regards to the French attitudes towards Poland. In years past, the French had consistently aimed at undermining the Austro-Russian influence in Poland, a policy seen most clearly in the support of Stanislaw Strzeżyński during the War of the Polish Succession. The defeat of the French candidate in that war did not mean the defeat of French ambitions for Poland. Augustus III couldn't live forever, and once he died, there would be a new opportunity to propose a new candidate for the Polish crown, whereupon a new chance to influence Poland to break with Russia would fall into Louis XV's hands. To prepare the groundwork for such a plan, from the mid-1740s, French diplomacy aimed at building up a secret support base for a new candidate, Louis XV's cousin, the Prince of Conti. Conti was to be supported in secrecy by several Polish nobles, many of whom had formed a diaspora around Stanislaus in the Duchy of Lorraine, and who were well received in Louis XV's court. The French court nicknamed the plan simply as The Secret, since so few people in France save Louis XV and Conti himself knew about it, and it formed the basis for a French reorientation of power in the East. We are reminded that in the previous loaded episode that we keep referring to, French diplomacy sought to engineer an agreement with Augustus III of Saxony in a bid to bring him into the French camp and thus bring Poland with him. The French were even willing to support Augustus III's son to sweeten this deal, but a break with Russia proved impossible for either Augustus or Count Brühl to support, and both figures instead attempted to vacillate between the two blocks. By 1748, it was apparent that Augustus would never be as concrete an ally in Poland as the French were looking for. From 1745, Conti had been allowed secretly to craft a league of Polish nobles in exile and at home who would be loyal to him and approve of his candidacy. And this secret scheme, originally seen as Plan B, and placed behind the apparently easier task of flipping Augustus's Saxon house, was thus accelerated after 1748. The primary aim in empowering the Poles with an independent candidate, totally supported by French money, was to undermine Austria and Russia and detract from Habsburg security in the East. Thus distracted, it was believed Austria would then be less secure in her position to send great legions across the Rhine as she had done. This policy with respect to Poland all made sense then, so long as Austria and France remained enemies. As the historian L.J. Olivier noted in his article appropriately titled France, Russia, and the Abandonment of Poland in the Seven Years' War, Conti's secret election scheme was predicated on French hostility to Austria. Olivier wrote, as a result, by 1755, the agency with the clearest idea of affairs in Poland and Russia was the secret organization of Conti and Louis XV. Its ultimate aim was always the exclusion of Russian influence in Poland, if any success were to be expected for the election of a French candidate to the Polish throne. Fortunately, during this period, the program of the secret and the policy of the French ministry ran separate but parallel courses. France and Prussia united against Austria, Russia, and England seemed a satisfactory general system for the protection of French interests. As soon as this system collapsed with the diplomatic revolution, though, French ambitions needed to change. The French couldn't very well agitate for a regime change of their choosing in Poland when in league with powers sensitive to interference in that sphere. French interference in Poland, fortunately for the court of Louis XV, had remained a near complete secret before the diplomatic revolution changed the French outlook. But as we'll see in later episodes, and I know this is into the future, the efforts to reimagine French interests in the Commonwealth were by no means easy. Seen in the sudden shock to old French diplomatic plans with respect to Poland, the term diplomatic revolution still holds water, though perhaps not as much as some general surveys of the period tend to suggest. The diplomacy up to 1748, which we have seen, was by no means clear-cut. It contained several powers eager for change, for greater advantages, and determined to forcibly alter the system of Europe when it became possible. Frederick II's invasion of Silesia in 1740 had forced the traditionally Prussophile British to come down heavily on the side of Austria, while we've already spent several breaths explaining how that stunning coup transformed the nature of diplomacy within the Holy Roman Empire. Saxony was cut adrift, and Bavaria sought first pro-French and then pro-Austrian policy lines, while George II of Britain and Hanover remained more fearful than ever of a Prussian assault on his German homeland, and he proved willing to negotiate a settlement with France before the bulk of the fighting had truly begun. Even before 1740, though, the influence of Cardinal Fleury in France and Robert Walpole in Britain led to the previously unimaginable Anglo-French Accord from 1716 to roughly 1731, while Franco-Spanish hostility up to that point and Austro-Spanish agreement at the same time was by no means permanent, and was altered in 1729 by the simple fact that Louis XV had been blessed with a son, and thus no longer had as much to fear from the ambitious Spanish Bourbon branch in any looming succession. Because as is probably obvious considering the amount of succession wars at the time, what Louis XV really feared was a Bourbon succession war. Anglo-Russian agreements further complicate the idea that the diplomatic revolution represented a perfect shift, for Britain had in fact agreed to join the so-called Alliance of the Two Empresses between Austria and Russia in 1748, as the Duke of Newcastle's hold on British foreign policy became stronger, and he looked at forming as strong an alliance as possible with Vienna. What Newcastle would seek to do after the event, in a bid to both prove British loyalty to Austria and to build a defensive league against France, was to implement the Imperial Election Scheme. This scheme will receive greater attention in future episodes, and don't worry, we will get a refresher on what's happening in 2 years' time, but like so many foreign policy developments in the 1750s, it had its genesis in 1748, so that's why we're mentioning it here. Basically, Newcastle aimed to get the agreement of 6 of the 9 electors, so that Austria's next succession would be more secure, and so that Joseph would succeed his father, Francis, as emperor, without a fourth war of succession blighting the century. Newcastle's efforts to acquire the necessary support and votes from both a financially conservative prime minister and brother, and from a reluctant king, make for interesting reading, but it was his diplomacy and his vision of how to build a league against France that demonstrates best the single-minded approach Newcastle had towards Europe. If the diplomatic revolution was a revolution to anyone, it was certainly one to Newcastle, who had spent the years between 1748 to 54 courting Austria with significant diplomatic aid, monetary contributions, and other costly devices, only to see Vienna swap into the French camp in 1756. Yet even that view, so long held, is not supported by the evidence. Austria didn't jump into bed with France willy-nilly, she did so out of perceived slights in British behaviour, first noticed in the British abandonment of Austria at the close of the War of the Austrian Succession, but felt most strikingly in the Convention of Westminster in January 1756, which saw Britain sign an accord with none other than Prussia. As you can see then, there's a great deal of diplomatic activity to come, and if we take the spotlight and shine it still harder onto Austria, then few events match the significance of the appointment of one of Austria's foremost chancellors and foreign policy coordinators. In episodes past, we have been introduced to Wenzel Anton, the Prince of Kaunitz-Reichenberg. In 1753, this prominent statesman at only 42 years old was made Chancellor of Austria, a position he was to hold for the next 40 years. Kaunitz's activity in the Habsburgs' Italian and Netherlands possessions in the 1740s and his presence at the peace negotiations of Aix-la-Chapelle in 1748 demonstrated Maria Theresa's growing faith in his abilities, but not even Kaunitz himself could have imagined that his tenure of service to the Habsburgs would stretch for such a period of time, including 4 decades, countless wars, and 4 Holy Roman Emperors. It was a stretch which ended only in his 83rd year in 1792, by which time Europe and the very notion of the order which Kaunitz represented was in flux. Kaunitz's equal in Austria in terms of length of service, if nothing else, must surely be judged to have been that other stalwart of Habsburg conservatism, Metternich. It is thus significant that it was considered a great honour and boon to his fortunes when Metternich managed to acquire the hand in marriage to Princess Eleanor von Kaunitz, the granddaughter of that veteran Austrian minister, from whom Metternich would surely have drawn inspiration. The imprint which Kaunitz left upon Austria during his tenure of service was only beginning to be felt in 1753, but even before then, with a stellar service record in Italy, the Netherlands and Aix-la-Chapelle, Kaunitz was assigned several tasks from 1748, which had a great impact upon both his career and the development of European relations. Kaunitz was the youngest member of the Austrian administration, at the age of 38, to take part in a set of state conferences in spring 1749 aimed at re-evaluating Austrian foreign policy. Our man William J. McGill, who provided us with a stellar and detailed background of Kaunitz in his previous article, examining his career in Italy and the Netherlands up to 1748, thankfully continued to write about Kaunitz up to the point of the first Polish partition. So, for the sake of a perspective on Austrian policy, McGill's articles are indispensable to us here. In his second article on Kaunitz, still in line with the roots of policy theme, McGill wrote that, following the conclusion of the negotiations in 1748, Austria turned to the task of re-evaluating her alliance system, a task taken up by the State Conference. The State Conference, the High Council of the Monarchy, was composed of 6 members, of whom Kaunitz, at 38, was the youngest. The most important discussions on the alliance system occurred in March and April 1749. On March the 5th, a royal resolution charged each councillor with preparing a statement on the monarchy's foreign policy and submitting it to Maria Theresa within a fortnight. The opinions were collected and presented to the Queen on March 18th. After debates in the conference, a list of conclusions was submitted to her on April 18th. As far as what was eventually agreed upon, some confusion reigns, thanks to the fact that while it was often written that Kaunitz's views on the need to repair French relations were later adopted, Kaunitz was himself sent away from the centre of power in Vienna and towards a new ambassadorial role in Versailles. As we'll see, this apparent demotion on Maria Theresa's part was in fact an effort to bring about an Austro-French rapprochement to fruition by his own hand. It has to be said that even considering the fact we now know how alliances flip-flopped all over the place before 1748, and though we've already noted that the diplomatic revolution wasn't as shocking as it's often presented as being, it's still striking to see just how radical a change in policy Kaunitz pushed for, perhaps because of the direct language he used in much of the ideas that he espoused. Such radicalism was based on his experiences and his cold perceptions of where British interests lay and why they seemed to consistently undermine Vienna. And it wasn't hard to criticise the history of Anglo-Austrian relations. The 1710s had seen the two powers aloof from one another, as had the 1720s. It was only in the early 1730s that an Anglo-Austrian rapprochement was cultivated, and this lapsed just in time for Britain to choose neutrality during the War of the Polish Succession, wherein Austria was only saved from worst losses by the timely Russian involvement. Indeed, Kaunitz argued that since the ministry of Robert Walpole from 1721 to 42, the English had been singularly unreliable, and their behaviour during the War of the Austrian Succession showed an obvious preference for Prussia. At Aix-la-Chapelle, the English had shown more concern for guaranteeing Prussian possession of Silesia than for any of Austria's needs. Having observed that the strongest bond of any alliance was the self-interest of the individual allies, Kaunitz pointed out that English self-interest was not limited to opposing French power, it also entailed restricting Austrian strength. Therefore, even Austria's self-interest vis-à-vis France was not always well served by England. The price of acquiring the active participation of the maritime powers in the recent war, Kaunitz declared, had been ridiculously high. Yet even then England had taken advantage of the opportunities available to defeat the mutual enemy. If self-interest was the glue of all good alliances, and if English self-interest required a policy inimical to Austrian self-interest, could England be regarded as a natural ally at all? Kaunitz gave his own view on this question, writing in March 1749 that, I am completely convinced that all extremes must be carefully avoided. The necessity of English aid must not be misjudged, and, though noting the opposing view of interests, we should not withdraw ourselves completely from English company. At the same time, my humble opinions, as meagre as they are aimed at bringing attention to the change in time and circumstances and to the dissolution of the prevailing view that regards England as a natural ally and as the guardian of the Habsburg dynasty. What Kaunitz wanted in 1749 was to avoid a reaffirming of the on-again, off-again alliance with Britain. The crux of his argument was that since peace was vital to the very survival of the monarchy in the aftermath of a ruinous and expensive war, Austria should avoid any provocation that might induce France to ally herself more closely with Prussia and thus to encourage Frederick to resort to violence again. In Kaunitz's mind, the reassertion of the traditional alliance system would be such a provocation, yet at the same time it wouldn't provide Austria with any more protection against the Franco-Prussian front than she had in the previous war. Kaunitz thus predicted a similarly deflating results in that conflict as before, where the French conquest of the Austrian Netherlands had only been forestalled by Louis XV's moderation at the peace table. Next time, if the French invaded Flanders and the Prussians invaded Silesia, Vienna may not be so lucky. This argument can be boiled down to the following two principles. Austria must not alienate England, but she must seek closer intimacy with potential allies elsewhere. Kaunitz stood apart from his colleagues because of the intensity of his anti-Prussian sentiment and because he alone spoke clearly about the possibility of seeking French support against Prussia. We remember that Kaunitz hailed from Moravia, where Prussian soldiers had passed through and suitably ravaged on their tour through provinces which didn't belong to them. This would have coloured Kaunitz's perspective in any case, but the clear threat that Berlin now posed to Vienna in terms of German primacy and Frederick's power gave the added incentives for Kaunitz to see Brandenburg-Prussia rather than France as the main enemy. Having asserted the primacy of the Prussian threat and underlined the weaknesses of the traditional alliance system, Kaunitz reviewed the history of Franco-Austrian relations and concluded, "It is therefore my humble opinion, after considering present circumstances and being on guard, that the French monarchy by one means or another could be persuaded not only not to oppose our undertaking against Prussia, but to offer some direct or at least indirect aid that would give us success." What Kaunitz and his peers managed to agree to in March 1749 was that since opposing both France and Prussia proposed such intense difficulties, a concerted effort should be made to split one from the other. There was no question about attacking France when Austria was a member of some alliance. Kaunitz remained laser-focused on attacking Prussia and partitioning her among the relevant powers. To this end, any peripheral concerns could be sacrificed, including Austrian interests in either the Netherlands or Italy. Eventually, Kaunitz concluded that it would be better to sacrifice Italy rather than the Netherlands, since giving Italy to France wouldn't spook or significantly concern the maritime powers as much as a sudden French occupation of Flanders would. "The bribe of the Italian lands may well be necessary," claimed Kaunitz, "because such a bribe could well heal any French animosity towards Austria in that theatre, and more simply, it would be the best means of buying French friendship, since subsidies to France were a financial impossibility." The benefits of a French friendship further appealed to Kaunitz because he imagined that if France and Prussia were separated, Austria might convince France to influence other powers, notably German states like Bavaria and Cologne, to withhold aid and comfort from Frederick. This would prevent Frederick from being able to call down on Austria such a swarm of enemies as he had attacked her with in 1741-42, when Prussia had been in collusion with Bavaria and Saxony. With the cooperation of the other German rulers, Austria would then be able to encircle Prussia. Kaunitz was in fact convinced that if Russia occupied Prussia in the east, no other direct aid would be needed, but unless Russia were an active ally, the whole plan was impossible, no matter what France did. The potential of an alliance with Russia was limited, however, by Russia's preoccupation with Sweden, demonstrated when a war between those two powers, between 1741-43, had preoccupied both for the majority of the War of the Austrian Succession. More importantly, in Kaunitz's mind, there was the question of the differences of opinion between Tsarina Elizabeth and her Chancellor, on the one hand, and the heir to the throne, the Grand Duke Peter, on the other. Given Elizabeth's propensity for high living and the uncertainty of her health, the possibility of a change of ruler and a change of Russian policy was very great. Incidentally, this was a very astute fear to have, because this change of ruler and change of policy was precisely what occurred, and at the most opportune time possible for Frederick in 1762, when the Tsarina Elizabeth did die, and the new Tsar Peter made a quick peace with Frederick, the man he supremely admired. An additional concern for Kaunitz in 1749 was that, although Russia was a great land power, she lacked money and effective military leadership. Unless these failings were remedied, Russia too had to avoid a war. Therefore, Kaunitz set as his immediate goal the separation of France and Prussia. No gains would be issued from France's neutralisation until Russia and Austria were prepared to take action. Until then, the neutralisation of France was defensive to limit Prussia's ability to do damage to Austria. In effect, Kaunitz denied that the old system of alliances with Britain was still valid, and he indicated the ingredients of a new system without jumping hastily ahead to the coalition that he did finally construct in 1756. All in all, in 1749, what Austria needed was peace and protection. So to obtain them, Kaunitz proposed a policy which centred on those principles of avoiding the alienation of the maritime powers and facilitating the isolation of Prussia, whose aggressive intentions were automatically assumed. Of course, if we consider the foreign policy aims of Britain, France, and Austria in the aftermath of the War of the Austrian Succession, then one of the most striking aspects of it, indeed of Kaunitz's view, was how contrary everyone's views were. Take Newcastle, for example. Newcastle set it as his mission to repair any damage done to Anglo-Austrian relations, even spearheading an ill-fated attempt to facilitate the election of Maria Theresa and Emperor Francis's son. Unbeknownst to the thoroughly pro-Austrian Newcastle, his opposite numbers in Vienna were of the opinion that the British alliance was basically worthless, and within a few years the most vocal and passionate believer in this position would be the Chancellor, that is, Kaunitz. Newcastle was thus committed to making a firm alliance with the partner who only wished to move forward in her relations while keeping everyone at arm's length, and the French policy aims were quite similar. The French desired a lasting peace in which urgent repairs could be made, and they wished still to engineer an eastern bloc against the Austro-Russians by way of the secret Polish election scheme we talked about. Perhaps it's just as well such a scheme remained secret, because had Kaunitz discovered the extent to which the French were trying to undermine Austria in such a sensitive region, he may well have soured on the idea of a rapprochement with France altogether, and affairs could well have progressed very differently. As the situation stood in 1749, then, the major powers possessed grand schemes and secret plans to guarantee their security and undermine their old rivals. As the 18th century reached its halfway point, though, there was no indication that any of these plans would be brought to yet another war, more devastating and disastrous than the one that had opened the century in the War of the Spanish Succession. In the next episode, well, in many years' time, I'm afraid, we will build our narrative towards that pivotal conflict, the Seven Years' War, which began in 1756 and which we have covered in our back catalogue before. I hope you're looking forward to that, and I hope you'll forgive me for taking this break. Trust me, it's necessary. Don't forget to listen to that Patreon update episode to find out why. Until then, though, until you meet Poland again and until you resume the story of this fascinating country in the 18th century, my name is Zach. This has been Poland Is Not Yet Lost, episode 40. Thanks so much for joining me and for listening in, and of course, for supporting. I'll be seeing you all soon.